past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online a master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The book at hand is certainly well-timed, although in sad fashion, all of us know that we are living not only through a pandemic, but also a pandemic that has wreaked havoc on the U.S. economy, and which has left many people without jobs, or in downscaled jobs, or just in a very uncomfortable position. And it's especially difficult when someone finds themselves in that position, when they are sort of at the midpoint or even in the latter point of their professional lives. And certainly it is an unhappy scenario in which to find oneself, but there are things you can do about it. And that is spelled out in really quite exciting fashion in a brand new book called Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need. This is written by best-selling author Fawn Germer, investigative journalist, actually, the author of a number of best-selling books. And this most recent, springing in part from some of her own personal experience and certainly from a lot of study that she has done, talks about how somebody caught in this unhappy situation can take initiative and do something about it. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Fawn Germer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I
have to say, I mean, there are no shortage of books, at least kind of generally of this ilk. And so I tend to actually approach them with some wariness. I have to say, I'm sincerely impressed with what this book offers. It's very well written, very well put together, and of course, speaks to something that is so very, very real. Can you just talk for a moment about the timing of this? I mean, I don't think you wrote this book because of the pandemic, but it does come at a time when a lot of people are feeling great insecurity about their own employment or maybe find themselves displaced for one reason or another.
Well, dude, I need to get you to write me an Amazon review. I love it. But I started working on this book almost 5 years ago, and it was because as a leadership speaker, I was at an event and when it wound down, a bunch of very well-known, high-profile senior executives retired to the lounge, and when they started talking about what was happening to them in their mid-careers, I realized this was an issue that was the same for my friends and neighbors all the way up the ranks. And I thought, oh, I'm going to write a book on age discrimination. And I found out that that is not the issue. The issue's relevance, and it's an issue that starts really in our 40s, and it's one that, if you're not playing it right, it could hit you in your 30s. But I wrote the book because people's careers were sputtering out because they weren't taking active steps to protect themselves. And when the pandemic happened, I realized I've got to hustle and update everything because it was already in line with the publisher, but I wanted everything to be up to date about COVID. And you know, as a news person, you just do it. So I dug deeper and updated it for what's happening in this kind of a crisis so that you can break through, because people who may be viewed as less desirable as employees are the ones who are the most unemployed. So we have a big challenge.
Hmm. One of the things that I appreciate about this book is that you really speak very directly, very frankly to somebody who finds themselves in this position and really call for them to take responsibility. And one of the first things you say when you kind of spell out the fact that there is, in fact, age discrimination and a very tough job market out there and things moving rapidly and so on. But you say it is a brutal reality, but before you start blaming everybody else, you have to own up to your part in it. So this is not an exercise in blaming others. This is about deciding what you can do about a really difficult situation.
Right, and it is contrarian to a lot of the books that you were talking about, because it would be really easy for me to write a book saying, oh, everything is great, this is what you have to do. But the truth is that the reason we are subjected to age bias is because there are assumptions which are largely true that most older people have not dug in and gotten so tech savvy that they can lead the change for the company and justify the fact that their salary is higher than somebody who's younger coming in out of school who actually is more tech savvy. So we have to figure out where we are and what we need to learn. The good news is, even if we think it is impossible to learn this stuff, it's not. And with a few months of intense work, you can not only get caught up, but you can find your place so that you're leading into the future. And then you are very valuable because you have better communication skills because you haven't always talked through text.
Hmm. At one point, there's a really interesting moment when you, in a sense, quote Mark Zuckerberg, although you are careful to say that this is just something he is reported to have said. Perhaps he did not say this, but he is reported to have said to an audience at Stanford University, young people are just smarter. And of course, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, and a lot of people would say it's also completely untrue, but be that as it may, you say, I'm actually glad if Zuckerberg said that. Explain why, in a sense, those words are a helpful, I suppose, call to action.
Because that shows exactly what people are up against. And that is assumption that younger people have it going on more than older. And that's what you're up against. And I gave a speech once to the Young Bar Association, and it was lawyers, I think, between the age of like 24 and 40. And there I was, and I looked and I said, okay, you guys can go ahead and be smug about this, but I believe in reincarnation, and by the time I come back and I'm your age, you're going to be pooping in your Depends. And they all laughed and they thought it was funny, but the truth is what goes around comes around, or what comes around goes around. I never get that right. But it payback, it's coming. So these younger people who are making judgments about older people are going to get it when it's their turn. But that's what we're up against. And some people break through, and I want to teach people how to be in that group to find success, to decide for themselves, maybe my greatest success is still in front of me. Maybe it hasn't even happened yet, instead of surrendering to the fact that nobody's going to want me because I'm over 45 or 50 or 55 or 60. You can make yourself very marketable.
Right. So again, I really appreciate the fact that this book is written from that perspective. At one point you say it's easier to blame discrimination than to blame yourself. And you are saying that in many cases, somebody who finds themselves in this situation bears some responsibility and needs to do something about it. Before we kind of get to that do something about it part, I want to talk just a little bit further about what maybe in some cases, certainly not in every case, but in many cases, is a certain kind of complacency in which a person in mid-career or late career is, in a sense, kind of coasting on things that they should not be coasting on. Things like, for instance, their experience. You have a chapter in the book called The Death of Experience that resonated very much with me. Explain the mistake that people are doing in terms of how they view themselves and their own experience.
Right. It's they have not come to the realization that experience is now almost a badge of doom instead of honor, because experience tends to mean age. It tends to mean old learning instead of new learning. And so it has been devalued so much, and a lot of people have not understood that. They want to be respected for it. And the complacency comes when people see trouble coming ahead and they say, oh, I'll just keep my head down, or I've only got 4 years until I retire. I'm going to just lie low. And that doesn't work. There are no jobs for coasters. And previous generations got respect after long and wonderful careers, and they did get to coast and rest on their laurels a bit. But that doesn't work anymore. Mm. The companies that can replace you with technology will replace you with technology. And if you're not delivering what you need to deliver to justify your paycheck, they will bring in younger, cheaper talent that will do it. So you've got to get out of denial. You have to take action.
I think this chapter spoke directly to me because I happen to be 60 years old, and in the music faculty where I teach, and actually my full-time job, I'm the second longest-termed member of that faculty department. And I think, as I look back, I find myself again and again kind of falling back on the fact that I have all of this institutional experience that, in some cases, I'm the only person on that faculty that remembers what happened 25 years ago with such and such. And as I read your book, I realized that, probably one of the biggest mistakes somebody in my position can do is sort of prattle on endlessly about what we did 25 years ago. I mean, once in a while, there are mistakes from 25 years ago from which we can still learn lessons. But it's important for me or anybody in my position to not sort of use that as a crutch or kind of an easy excuse for me to still be around. I mean, I need to be around for a whole lot of reasons than just because I've been there a long time.
You do want to shut up about everything that happened a long time ago. Nothing irritates younger people more than when you tell them something that they need to know that you learned at IBM two decades ago. And so that's a problem. However, once you bring them in and you're working together and build those alliances, those stories do become more interesting to them. They are not selling points to get you employed or justify your employment, but they can be interesting later on. And before we get to the next question, I just got to tell you how nice it is to do an interview with somebody who's actually read the book. So thank you for that.
I've read it and enjoyed it. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Fawn Germer about her latest book called Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want when you've Lost the Job You Need. Just a moment more on this kind of matter of the complacency that some people in this position are inadvertently guilty of. One of the things you say is that in many cases, people in this position are counting on outdated or useless skills to define their worth at work. Can you give maybe a tangible example of that?
Now, you know that since I wasn't ready for that, I can't think of a single thing. But what it is that the life, you know that's how that works, right? But the lifespan of a skill used to be that you thought, I'll get out of college and this will last me from now until forever, until I retire. And then it started to speed up. And now they say that the half-life of a skill is somewhere between 2 and 5 years. So if you're, I have a ton of skills that are useless. You know, I'm really good at faxing stuff, right? So, but as a former reporter, think about all of the things I learned to do that are completely different now because of the advent of internet and changes in news cycle and the way people consume news. And social media, that especially with that. There are a lot of people who got older, and they saw all of this change happening so swiftly, and it was terrifying. So they just held their breath. And they'd say things like, oh, I'm not going to get on Twitter. People don't need to know when I'm going to the bathroom. I don't need to tell them that. And didn't realize that there was a revolution coming. And the most significant thing I've heard a public person say is, and this was Justin Trudeau at Davos, he said, never in history have things changed so quickly, and never again will they change this slowly. Hmm. And that's it. It's just our skills are constantly getting more out of date, so it's on us to figure out what's coming. The good news is we can do that.
Hmm.
Bad news is if you don't do it and it's rolling downhill like this big old snowball, you're going to get rolled over by it.
Hmm. So that is, of course, a big part of your book as well, is how to move ahead in such an environment in which so many things are changing. And although there is a whole lot of advice that you share, one of the most basic, which I really appreciated, was when you said that essential for long-term survival is insatiable curiosity. Explain why this is so much the key to everything that you talk about in your book.
Because companies want one thing. They want relevance. And to have relevance, you have to be a lifelong learner. You can't close the book. You can't think you've gotten there. You haven't. It's not done. And so what you have to do is read, 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 read. That means every day you are reading Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, Inc., Fast Company, or hitting these websites. You don't read every single article, but read the summary so you know what's going on in the world, and then read the go deeper with the articles that are interesting to you or that you think are significant. And then you pay attention to podcasts and things talking about the future, and you take classes. That's the best learning available. And the good news is it's free. And think about this. You can go to Coursera.org or edX.org and get classes taught by Harvard professors, Cambridge, Berkeley, just really great schools, and take innovation or artificial intelligence or any of these things that are going to be much more important as you grow your career, the latest things, and it is free. And best of all, I found this when my first one that I took was an innovation class from MIT, is that it hit me. I don't need to be worrying about these tests or trying to perform on this. I have my degrees. I don't need another degree. I need the information. So I go in there. I get the learning. It is the most current learning available for free. And then when I talk to people, I mention things that I've learned in these courses, and I just sound like I am all that. And believe me, it's not that hard to do it. You don't have to learn to be a programmer. You have to learn when you're going to need the program and how it can be applied to your discipline so that you are truly valuable.
Mm. Yeah, I at one point you write this, you may have a lot to learn, but there are so many easy ways to learn it that all you have to do is make up your mind, open up your mind, and then put your mind to work. And that's one way, probably in a very positive way, that we should be glad that the world has changed, because what you just said there would not have been true really even 20 years ago, and for sure 30 years ago, I mean,
right.
In terms of what is available to us. At one point, you quote a mentor of yours who worked for Procter & Gamble. You asked her what her advice would be in terms of coaching somebody in this situation, and one of the things she talked about was the thing about being a lifelong learner. Another thing was the know thyself, which we talked about at the beginning in terms of really looking at yourself honestly. But I want you to talk for a moment about her second point, which I really liked, which her advice is every day do something that scares you. Get out of your comfort zone. Why do you think that is so valuable?
Oh, because fear is what has put us behind. That's why we hunkered down. We thought we were behind. And I've got a really good story that illustrates it. So when I was a reporter years ago, I was in Denver, and they were getting these new machines that were going to give us access to something called the Information Superhighway. And I kept hearing Information Superhighway, Information Superhighway, and the machines arrived, and then they had the training when I was on vacation. So I missed the training on the information superhighway, came back, and, you know, of course I'm talking about the internet, right? But I come back, and I see all of these other reporters getting on the information superhighway, and there's not another training scheduled, and I'm terrified, and I don't know what to do, and I keep thinking my career is over because I don't know how to use the information superhighway. What am I going to do? And then finally, the woman who sat across from me came back to her desk, and I looked at her, and I said, I don't know how to use the information superhighway. She goes, oh, come here. So she drags me over to a computer, gets me on a search engine. She says, what are you working on? And I said, a series on casino gambling. Okay, type that in, casino gambling. She hits it, right? All these articles pop up. She goes, click one. I clicked it. She goes, now you know how to use the information superhighway. Sometimes we just have to sit down and admit we don't know something and then learn it. It's not that hard. And if I can prattle on a little bit more, there's a really great example about how you do this. The knowledge of this blockchain technology just blew me away. It was so beyond my grasp. And blockchain fuels a lot of supply chain, and it's what is behind Bitcoin and all the cryptocurrency. And I couldn't get it. Every time I read about it, I didn't understand it, so I started looking at YouTube videos. I still didn't understand it. And then I came across a YouTube video on how to teach blockchain to a five-year-old. And I watched that four-minute video, and then I understood it. So find the easiest way to get the information and then grow it.
Right. And, of course, that all starts with being genuinely curious, I mean, and seeking out whatever it takes to learn what it is you need to learn. In our last couple of minutes, I want to give you a chance to talk about something that's really important that we've not yet really touched on very much, and that is millennials. The fact there's a whole chapter called Those Millennials, in which you talk about how in many cases someone who is a little bit older finds themselves with a boss or supervisor who is a millennial, and often there is a real dissonance between people of those very different generations. What is your advice for the mid to late career professional who finds themselves being supervised by a millennial that's driving them crazy?
Yeah, the first thing is to not judge them or make assumptions about them. The boomers did a terrible job about welcoming that generation into the workplace because they saw them as irresponsible, they didn't work hard enough, they worked different, they would march into the CEO's office, they didn't know chain of command, they wanted everything now and didn't want to earn their way up. The problem was the millennials delivered. They were so brilliant with their technology that they were more valuable to their companies. And so they are now rising into the ranks and are the leaders and are the hiring managers. So if you can't see the value in what they know, you are of no value to them because you won't be a good team player. So you have to admit they know what they're doing. It's just different than we always did it. And then seek ways to build relationships with them and hopefully get some cross-mentoring so you can learn about what's important to them and they can learn the communication skills that are your strength.
Mm. One of all, just of many, many points of great advice which are shared in this wonderful book, which really in the end is all about upskilling, about transforming yourself from who you were into an even more valuable employee in a time when that is more valuable than ever. The book, again, is Coming Back, How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need, published by St. Martin's Press, the author, Fawn Germer. Fawn Germer, thank you so much for giving this world this wonderful book.
Thank you so much. Okay, take care.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And now an interview that comes from the Morning Show Archive. We're spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with a woman by the name of Anna Sabino, who is actually the designer behind a highly regarded jewelry brand called Lucid New York. And Anna Sabino made the decision to, in a sense, leave a nice, solid life on Wall Street to embark on a more creative venture with her own jewelry collection. And she has done very, very well. But rather than just sit on her own success, she is really anxious to help others experience similar success in their own lives with their own creative ventures. So she is a certified career coach and has written a really interesting book called Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle, in which she shares some of her experiences with this new venture for her and offers some very practical suggestions for anybody who would like to launch something similar. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Anna Sabino about her very interesting story and very interesting book. Anna Sabino, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
I've sketched out just the barest minimum of your own life story, which is really so interesting. So let's give you a chance to describe it in a little more detail. Explain to our listeners what you were doing professionally and then what you decided to do quite differently then.
Sure. So I was on Wall Street and had a job as a market analyst, which basically involved sitting at a desk for 10 hours a day, not too much interaction with customers, etc. So I felt pretty limited. I felt that my growth, my professional growth, had like a box around it, that I couldn't really be in charge of my career, my future. So I started working on making a transition. I really felt this hunger of starting something on my own, on living on my own terms and being in charge of my time. So it took a while to get it off the ground, and I chose a safe approach because I think entrepreneurship in itself is pretty risky. So instead of just quitting my Wall Street job and cushy paycheck, I decided to start my creative career and still be on Wall Street for about a year until my jewelry brand Lucid New York took off.
And, of course, it has been a very, very exciting success with maybe one or two bumps along the way. But generally speaking, it has done very, very well. So as we explore your book and what you have to say to people, one of the most important things to talk about is this matter of creativity and the fact that, in your words, we are all creative. So but a lot of people don't tend to think of themselves as creative and tend to think that a creative venture like yours is something they couldn't possibly even think about doing. What is your notion of creativity and how do you want people to think about their own creativity?
So I do think that we are all creatives and we tap into our creativity daily, even you know, deciding about our next career move, our next task, and approaching all that creatively, because we are not all the same. So we don't, for example, approach a transition or a change in the same way, and we don't even approach success the same. Although society is trying to condition us or pressure us into thinking of success in financial terms. But for some of us, it may be having more time to spend with our family or traveling or creating a location-independent lifestyle. So
creativity comes into play as far as approaching our future steps, decision we make daily. It's all tapping into our resources, our creativity, our creative self.
So you suggest that really everybody needs to sort of ask themselves what they want to do with their life. And in many cases, it will be something more creative than maybe they are doing at the moment. And this is an important possibility to at least consider. In the course of doing that, one of your bits of advice is that people should stretch their walls. What do you mean by that? What is the importance of stretching your walls, and what are you saying there?
Yeah, Greg. So I think in our careers and lives, we tend to just keep repeating and doing the same thing over and over because it's just comfortable and we don't feel the push or the pressure. But taking a step back and stretching ourselves a bit, doing different things, taking on different projects, even if they don't seem to be comfortable at first, can be really good for our self-discovery, for our career, because we may discover what we like doing, what we don't like doing, what gives us true joy. But by doing, you know, repeating our routines and just, you know, sometimes we say we just go with the flow. But no, instead of going with the flow, taking a charge of our flow and choosing things that we can engage in, choosing new things, approaching new people, scheduling new coffee talks with people we've never met, reaching out can be extremely beneficial to our lifestyle design.
One of the things that you take a little time to talk about is that to do what, for instance, you did in terms of launching your own jewelry line, one of the things that you had to do was you had to be willing to accept the discomfort of being at zero. That is, starting from nothing. And you, I think you're absolutely right when you say that when people talk about this, especially when people who are quite successful look back at the beginning and they will talk about, yeah, I started this from scratch, but they kind of breeze over the reality of what that really feels like to begin with, in a sense, not much of any money in the bank and no successes to build upon. I mean, it can be a very, very daunting situation. And I think you're telling people you need to be prepared for what that feels like to start from the ground up, starting at zero.
Yes, and it can be extremely lonely because not many people understand us, especially those with 9-to-5 jobs and steady paychecks who are not at zero, who don't have to build anything from scratch. And the most challenging, I think, in this stage that we all go through, not once, but multiple times in entrepreneurship, is that we don't know when that stage is going to end. It's not guaranteed that we have an end in mind, that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, that after, let's say, a month or a year, you know, we will succeed. We don't see it. We don't know it. So we are basically putting all this energy and effort, tremendous amount of time into something that we don't know the result of. And it's usually unpaid. So for those who transition from traditional jobs, it can be very challenging if they're used to getting paid for results right away, steady paychecks, weekly paychecks. But that's the price that we pay to truly build something that we want, to step into the career path that we've always wanted. It's not easy. It has roadblocks. It can be discouraging because nobody likes zero readers, zero followers, zero customers, but this is definitely a part of the process.
We're speaking with Anna Sabino about her book, Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle. Much of the book includes very practical advice, in part because, as you tell us, it isn't just about whether or not you are creatively talented, but whether or not you have the skills and the determination to do something with it. You write at one point, "We've always put talent on a pedestal, but it's actually its application that matters. Our perseverance and commitment to our goals is more important than our talent." And I suppose if somebody sort of blunders into this kind of a venture thinking that just their sheer talent and creativity will be enough, they are likely to fail rather miserably.
Yes, I see it often that very talented people create pieces and then they don't know what to do with them. And the danger here is that they often think that the making process stops at creating. But nowadays, we all have to be involved after we created something. It's about distribution, about selling, marketing, personal branding, etc. And there are no excuses anymore. We can't say it's not for me, I'm not cut for business, I'm not cut for marketing. It's the space, the entrepreneurial space, is just too competitive. The barriers of entry are very low. Everybody can start a business. So it's, you know, we all have to be involved in all the steps of making it. It's not just creating and then waiting what's going to happen. Of course, you can get lucky, but in a lot of cases, you may just wait and wait and wait. So to take it into your hands, I would strongly suggest that you devote your energy into creating and at the same time into marketing and spreading the word about what you're offering.
I really appreciated some of your thoughts on avoiding creative block. And I know in some of the ventures in my own life that this has sometimes been an issue, or it's been hard for me to write or hard for me to compose music for one reason or another. You speak especially interestingly about this in a section titled Woman with Her Back to the Ocean View, in which you suggest that someone doing this should think about the space or the place in which they are doing their creative work, and maybe think about different kinds of spaces. How has this worked for you, and what suggestions do you have for people in terms of thinking about where geographically they should do this creative work?
Well, it's an exploration, definitely, because it's very personal. I personally have to be in movement. I do a lot of work on my phone. I have to change locations. But a lot of creatives, I think, make space in their homes or studios, and they almost force themselves to create things only there, because their desk is pristine, everything is ready, and they are ready to write. And sometimes it may not happen because this may not be an environment for them. I know that for some, ambient noise works really well. So that's why we see so many creatives in coffee shops. And being in movement or taking, exercise breaks is very, very beneficial to the creative flow. But I would say if we feel not inspired in this space, even though it's our home, let's change it. Let's change it because it hasn't been working. And what I noticed for me, I try not to focus on just 3 to 4 hours blocks of time, but I try to utilize even 15 to 20 minutes, even when I'm waiting in line or if I'm at a parking lot, and just tap into my creativity. If it starts flowing, why wait? These 20 minutes can be way more precious than 3 hours that we blocked for creating, just because we feel inspired and inspiration is precious. I grab it whenever I can. Mm-hmm.
You also have a interesting idea about how somebody who is engaged in this kind of creative venture might be really tempted to follow their own passion, which sounds really good, but can be sometimes quite impractical. If your passion is leading you to paint paintings or create pottery or write songs that nobody wants to purchase. And so you are, I think, suggesting or reminding us that you need to have some kind of a balance between your own passion and gaining a sense of what the world is interested in purchasing from you. What are your suggestions on keeping these two matters in balance? Two matters which might in some ways seem kind of diametrically opposed to each other.
Yeah, Greg. So let's assume here that we are talking about creative careers. We are not talking about creative hobbies, because if you have a hobby, you could do whatever you want. But if I believe that if you want to start a business, a sustainable business, where you charge, you're able to, to pay your bills with, you have to come up with a system, with a strategy. You have to keep your customers in mind, because ultimately they're going to be paying for your work. So it's not just about you and what you like and your family and friends, but it's total strangers who are going to be supporting your business by buying your pieces. So I believe that testing as early as you can and getting feedback, and that can be sometimes harsh, but if we transform the critiques into the feedback and distill the best out of it and just build upon it to create something that people want and want to pay for it, we set ourselves up for success. And I think engaging our customers in the early stages of creating is very important. I don't think creating in solitude for a long time and then revealing, surprising. I don't think customers really do want to be surprised that much. They'd rather have a product that will solve their problems. They'd rather have a say in our creating. They want to have it customized. The surprise matters less than we think it does.
You also have some advice that I wanted to be sure to ask you about, because this was one of the biggest things in the book that had not really dawned on me until I read your book. And that comes down to the matter of timing. And you say that in many cases, creative people or people interested in launching a creative venture are sometimes really obsessed with the notion of being first, of being really early, ahead of the curve, which, of course, in at least certain cases, can be very, very advantageous. But more often than not, lunging at something early, prematurely, can lead to the downfall of a venture. What is your advice in terms of timing and this notion of being early versus being right?
So often it's our ego. We want to be inventors. We want to be looked up at. But I think striving to be first and rejecting ideas just because they've been done before is a risky strategy, because we can't. Let's put it that way. It's really risky if we are not. It's not risky for celebrities, for example, because they can, start or invent anything they want. But to start from something from scratch is just, we don't know how it's going to be received. But let's say we are the second one in a row, then we can kind of ride the wave of the popular product that are already there. And there is nothing wrong with being second, third, fourth, with, building upon the idea. Not all of us have to invent. Inventing is challenging this world where it seems that everything has been invented. So what I say and what I truly believe in is it's not about the idea. It's about its execution. So if we are second or third, but if we actually execute better than the first person, we can actually be way more successful than the inventor.
I want to finish by having you talk about the importance of disavowing ourselves of the myth of the overnight genius. This myth is certainly pervasive in our culture, and I think you feel like this is really counterproductive when we let ourselves get caught up in this myth. Where did this myth come from, and why do we need to try to disengage ourselves from such a myth?
Yeah, so the media, social media, definitely feeds that dissatisfaction. We look at others and we see their followers, likes, popularity, platform, and we just think that everything just showed up to them like that. But we didn't see the struggle. We didn't see the tears and months or years of posting content or working towards some unknown goal. And I think just minding our own creative path and staying where we are and truly enjoying the process can be something that we should make ourselves aware of if we want to succeed in the creative field, because it can be extremely destructive to our own creative career, to our own life, to focus on the dissatisfaction, because there's always going to be somebody who started earlier, who has more resources. So all these excuses are stopping so many of us from starting businesses, writing books, and we don't see these things because of the insecurity of not being enough. So I would like to just conclude this thought saying we are enough. We have enough. We have everything that can take us to start what we want to start.
The book again is Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle. The book is published by Career Press, and you can find out even more information about Anna Sabino at her website, annasabino.com. Anna Sabino, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I enjoyed our conversation, and I enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Greg. It was a pleasure.
Monday on The Morning Show, I'm very excited to be reconnecting with composer James Stevenson, who's been on The Morning Show a couple of times before, a past composer in residence with the Racine Symphony, artist in residence at Carthage College. And we're going to be talking on Monday about a great honor he was given. His wonderful Fanfare for Democracy was played at the inauguration of our new president, Joe Biden. And we'll talk with James Stevenson about that. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. We remind you that you can subscribe to the Morning Show as a podcast, and this weekend I'll be offering up a conversation from many years ago with Dr. Sam Chell talking about one of his